I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today we have two guests, David Wondrich and Noah Rothbaum. David is the editor-in-chief and Noah the associate editor of the new Oxford Companion to Spirits and Cocktails, and they team up to host the podcast Life Behind Bars. David and Noah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Welcome. I can't believe I said that. I'm so used to doing a podcast that I'm always the one saying welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Exactly. Now it's on the other foot. Here we are. Thank you so much.
So it's a tremendous volume and 800 pages, 9 years, 150 contributors, and there's an enormous amount of material about the business of spirits and cocktails. So first, I was wondering if you could give us an overview of how you approach telling the business story as opposed to the culture or the history of your subject.
Well, I guess I'll start and then Noah, please jump in. One thing, it was kind of one of the central principles of the book that the business is important because that shapes what we drink. It shapes how spirits get around the world. It shapes what's available. And it's not a story that's often told very much. You get a lot of stuff about distillation and very little bit about how the stuff gets into the bottle and into the customer's hands. And we thought that was actually very interesting. And that's something that really hasn't been researched so much. There's no book telling the global history of the spirits trade, for instance. And that kind of blew our minds.
Yeah, I mean, my first book was that came out in 2007. It was actually called The Business of Spirits. So it's sort of come full circle where at the time in 2007, really, you know, some of the only stories that people wanted to hear about cocktails and spirits were about the business of the industry, right? Like, you know, the mergers, the acquisitions, the marketing geniuses, the entrepreneurs. And then really for the next, whatever it is, 13, 14 years, the focus has shifted a lot towards, you know, the actual making of drinks, recipes, the bartenders, the culture of spirits and cocktails. And the whole kind of business has sort of taken, you know, a backstage to that, has sort of faded into the background. So it's kind of amazing that we've come full circle here.
Your book is filled with great business stories, and one of the best is about Pernod Ricard's purchase of Irish distillers. Tell us about that story.
Well, it is a great story. In 1988, Irish Distillers was the only distilling company in Ireland. It had the only distilleries in Ireland that were operating. Another small startup had just started, but they hadn't put anything on the market yet. And they really only had two distilleries, the large one in Middleton in the Irish Republic and Bushmills up north. And they were dying. They were undercapitalized. They had very little export. They couldn't compete with the blended scotch. And they were really struggling. And at that point, the Grand Metropolitan Company in England thought that they would make a good purchase because they could sell off a bunch of the brands and break the thing up and make a lot of money on it. And the people at Irish Distillers were horrified. They'd been trying really hard to preserve distilling in Ireland and to preserve this tradition of distilling for so many decades that they had. And they had plans for recovery. Even as this was going on, they got into a program to replace their tired old barrels with new barrels and, you know, a big capital investment there. And like I said, they were horrified. So they looked around and they said, we need somebody to buy us who's not going to cut us up, who's not going to destroy the company. And they didn't look to America or England. They looked to France, which has traditionally been an ally of Ireland, and found the Pernod Ricard company, which had one overseas brand at the time. They had bought Wild Turkey. I don't know what made them buy Wild Turkey, but they bought Wild Turkey. And that was their only non-French brand. And Irish Distillers went to them and said, we need you to buy us. And Pernod thought about it and basically gave them a friendly takeover offer, which they immediately accepted. And they've been almost partners ever since. It's amazing.
And I think that fits into like a much larger story of, you know, the business of whiskey, where for hundreds of years, Ireland has in making, you know, first single malt and then blends. And, you know, it really is this huge, you know, kind of major industry. And the 20th century, you know, the whole of Ireland, it's sort of the whole, the whiskey industry is poised to have this amazing century. And, you know, a whole number of factors kind of interrupt that. And Ireland kind of gets knocked off their trajectory as being this major player in the whiskey industry. And Dave said, I mean, it's really holding on for dear life. You know, the 1970s in America, whiskey reaches its height of popularity. And then for the next, you know, 25, 30 years, it's sort of all downhill. So the Irish distillers who were left were really holding on for dear life. So it's kind of an amazing comeback story that now it's a no-brainer when you walk into a bar or a liquor store, you know, you'll see now all types of whiskey coming out of Ireland and Scotland and America. But for a long time, it really looked like whiskey might fade away and mm-hmm. be replaced by the white spirits.
And we also meet a number of entrepreneurs in your book. I think of Ron Cooper and Sidney Frank, just to name two.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about them and you know, the entrepreneurs you really enjoyed writing about or editing as you were putting this together.
I mean, there are so many going back centuries. James Ashley, who ran the London Punch House in 1731 and went to the docks and bought his own spirits and aged them himself in his cellars so that he could undersell his competitors and bring punch down to make it something affordable. And that kind of kicked off the modern world of mixed drinks. So, I mean, it starts with him, but there's so many types. There's Michel Roux is a favorite, who was a French paratrooper in Algeria, a very tough man. Then he went into the wine business and was in Texas selling wine and got into running fine dining restaurants there and then got back into selling spirits and ended up selling Absolute Vodka. I mean, it's stuff like that. And that was the biggest brand of its day. And so there's all kinds of people like that that really just pop out in the book. Noah, they must have some favorites.
Yeah, I think that you see these sort of large personalities throughout the history of spirits and cocktails really kind of changing the course of what we drink and how we drink. And you mentioned Sidney Frank. I mean, I think that people think that he came out of nowhere to create Grey Goose, but, you know, he had been married to a woman whose father was a big liquor executive, and Sidney Frank himself, like, had run, you know, one of the largest liquor companies for years before being pushed out and sort of reinventing himself. And he starts with Jägermeister, and he turns this very bitter German liqueur, which I don't think anybody really thought would be a big seller, into a phenomenal success. Another one, Louis Rosenstiel, you know, who was Sidney Frank's father-in-law, who ran Schenley and created this behemoth of a company and really kind of changes whiskey history. A lot of his marketing, both his foresight and also some of the things that he got wrong and the way that he had to sort of recorrect his business dealings, you know, definitely change whiskey history.
One of the entries, it may be, Noah, that you wrote this, but one of the entries mentions how packaging, even something like the Elvis decanter, really helped save the bourbon industry in the 70s and 80s. Could you talk about that episode and then just the importance of packaging almost throughout the history of spirits as brands?
Well, you know, it's funny. My last book, which is called The Art of American Whiskey, is a visual history of American whiskey told through label art and bottle design and old photos. And whiskey sales in America reached its height in 1970. And then it's pretty sad times for most brands. And one of the ways that they held on were all these amazing novelty ceramic decanters, you know, as you said, Elvis. I remember as a kid seeing them in liquor stores, there would be, you know, fire trucks and cars. And if you go to Jim Beam today, they have a whole room at their distillery full of all of these amazing decanters that they made for the Republican National Committee, the Democratic National Committee. It didn't matter. They would make a decanter for anybody if they thought that they could sell the whiskey. And some of them actually turned out to be kind of lead-based decanters. So, you know, if, you know, people now collect them, but, like, I would definitely caution your listeners, like, maybe not to drink the whiskey in those decanters if they're still full, because some of those were lead-based ceramics. But, you know, they were trying to do anything. I mean, we saw, like, a company like Brown-Forman, which obviously owns Jack Daniels and a lot of other famous brands, you know, got into a lot of different businesses. They were in the luggage business. They owned Lennox, the China company. You know, you see Jim Beam become part of Fortune Brands, where it's, you know, they're at tailor-made golf clubs and cigarettes and all types of businesses, Moen Fawcett, just to kind of almost spread their luck across multiple industries. So, it seems inconceivable now, but like that's what sort of got spirit companies through the hard times. Even Diageo, in one of its permutations, owned the Glen Eagles golf course and also Burger King at one point. So, I mean, it's only in recent times that they sort of shed their non-liquor brands and focused exclusively as the industry has taken off.
Both of you have been both witnesses to and important participants in the cocktail revolution of the last generation. How has that changed how spirits are marketed and sold?
Well,
how many hours do we have?
So many ways. Yeah. I mean, you really see the spirits who followed kind of the older model and said, well, you know, our spirit is too good to be mixed in cocktails. And, you know, I'm kind of looking at cognac right now. Now are really playing catch up because they missed a whole generation of drinkers who were very, very interested in cocktails. And the spirits that work best in cocktails climbed and climbed. The spirits like whiskey, which has always been mixed in drinks. So American whiskey was always very cocktail friendly. Gin, of course, and gin sales have climbed after years of decline. And the top rated gins are doing quite well. Any category that was heavily invested in cocktails has prospered from it. And people have noticed that brands of individual brands have prospered. Brands that were completely dead, like Plymouth Gin, became, at least for a while there, they became real darlings of the press and of cocktail drinkers and did very well. So it's kind of fun to watch.
And I think the kind of rebirth of the cocktail also sort of signals like a greater change in consumer behavior, right? And yet the sort of rise of foodies and hipsters and people who are going out of their way for products that are, you know, artisanal and handmade and have sort of an old fashioned sensibility about them. And both spirits and cocktails had sort of fallen so much out of popularity that they were kind of ripe for this comeback, right? Because we like to say you don't drink what your parents drink, but you drink what your grandparents drink, right? So it's kind of generational. And by the time that the cocktail really comes back, starting really in the, I don't know, what do you say, Dave, like late 90s, mid to late 90s?
Yeah, early 2000s, I think it really became apparent that it was back around 2005.
And you have a whole renaissance of like the Rat Pack and that movie Swingers and swing dancing, you know, all of this sort of comes back and the birth of like California wine and craft beers. I mean, all of this helps change the way that people think. And it almost went from everybody wanted brand names, big brands, everybody wanted Kleenex and Tropicana orange juice. And then it went to this, like people wanted kind of find the most obscure and artisanal whiskeys and gins and rums and prove their merits as a bartender or home bartender and spirits collector with all these sort of oddities and rarities.
And one of the things that really shows you how things have changed is the previous generation spirits trends were butterscotch flavored schnapps, flavored vodkas, Midori melon liqueur, and things like that. And this generation's trendy spirits are rye whiskey, gin, funky rum, and mezcal. So you really can see the difference. You know, it's not subtle.
I'm glad we're on this side of the pendulum.
I've been on both.
So this raises the point of craft distilling, which is a major subject in your book. And on the one hand, there's this much greater ability to produce and market smaller batch, higher end spirits. On the other hand, the large beverage companies have immense need for products to put through these massive sales and distribution networks that they have. So where are we now with that tension? And how does that tension play out over, say, the last generation?
Well, I mean, this isn't quite about craft spirits, but when I started going down to Kentucky and asking them about rye whiskey at the big distilleries, they'd laugh and say, son, we spill more bourbon in a day than we make rye in a year, and it was just really not a part of their business. And they looked at the craft spirits the same way. Is like, what are these gnats buzzing around us? You know, we don't need anything they have. They don't know how to distill, which many of them didn't. They don't know how to run a business, and nobody's ever going to buy this stuff. They're charging $48 for a bottle of whiskey when we've got something that's fully matured for $22 that's way better. And that was their thinking. They didn't see that these businesses were starting the same way their businesses had started, and that they were ramping up fast, and that they connected with individuals on a local level and offered them something personalized and local and not cookie cutter. And it took them a long time to start to catch up, that's for sure. Now they've realized that the best thing to do is use these small companies as incubators and let them grow to a certain point and then step in and buy the winners. And they've been very successful at that lately.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, you get this like weird game of big brands trying to pretend like they're small brands, right? Where, you know, this idea that Maker's Mark is this tiny brand that you and your friends have just discovered, right? And like, meanwhile, they're the largest whiskey brands in America. And you get this sort of weird game where some of the small brands are trying to act like they're bigger than they are, right? To attract distributors and get attention. And a lot of the bigger brands are trying to pretend like they're smaller brands to get the artisanal and craft credibility.
I mean, a healthy liquor ecosystem has both. That's what we had in the 19th century and up until Prohibition, and briefly after Prohibition until World War II, is you had big companies and small companies, and they all kind of were able to effectively share the marketplace, each filling some needs and drawing on each other's resources as needed.
So this is also a major theme almost throughout the history of bourbon and American whiskey, that these brands have been sold with a story that's maybe very different from the real story of their being owned and distributed by a large company.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is the truth. I mean, at the beginning, I mean, there was really no market for specialty whiskey, right? It was more of a problem if, you know, you found that, like, you know, some of the barrels were particularly good, right? I mean, they would be either blended into the regular whiskey that you were selling, or maybe the distiller and the people who worked at the distillery would drink them. But like, there was really no market to sell them, and stores didn't want this, bars didn't want this. So it was more of a problem, and consistency was kind of the name of the game. So really with, sort of the success of Booker No, who was Jim Beam's grandson, sort of his creation of his namesake Booker's and also a number of other whiskeys, really do we get this idea that like people want seasonal releases, people want stuff that doesn't taste exactly like the house brand, that maybe it's funkier, it's higher proof, it has a slightly different flavor. I mean, all of that we kind of take for granted now as a fairly new concept, where before it was all just each brand only made a few releases, and that's essentially what they made every year, all year.
Which brands would you say have done a particularly good job of keeping themselves fresh and relevant over the last decade?
Well, Buffalo Trace and the whiskey business.
Absolutely.
I mean, oh my God. They have functioned essentially as like a portfolio of small brands while being the biggest distillery in the whiskey business in America. And yet they're all of their small brands are hotly sought after and are really not small at all. But they've managed to give that impression that it's just almost like a collective of artisans or something, which is very amusing, but also very successful.
There's a great entry in your book on bartenders and how bartenders are critical, literally tastemakers in this world, that they are people whom companies send brand ambassadors to, whom the beverage companies court. What role have bartenders come to play in the spirits and cocktails world from a business perspective in the last generation? And what are the most important trends you're seeing in cocktails now that the spirits companies have to respond to?
Well, bartenders sort of became the alpha customers for brands. If you could convince bartenders, not, you know, in every bar, just in kind of tastemaker bars and craft cocktail bars, which are, after all, the only bars that got press anymore. If you could convince bartenders there that your brand was cool, they would put it in their cocktails and stick it in the middle of their back bar and talk it up to their customers. And to the customers, that served as an absolutely crucial endorsement as a supposedly disinterested party who was an expert in all things booze, as bartenders wanted to show themselves. You know, the fact that that person was into this brand, it must be good. And some of the early companies that leaned on that, one of them was, one of the early brands was Plymouth Gin, that reached out to bartenders and did a huge amount of bartender engagement. They were great pioneers, and then everybody followed on that. And, you know, there have been a few others, but it was very successful. Now, I think we're seeing things change. People aren't really seeing their bartenders as much. There's a lot of outside drinking. There's a lot of canned drinks going out, and we'll see what happens. It's going to be different, and I think the companies are going to have to lean back to appealing directly to the consumers rather than going through these middlemen. I don't know. What do you think, Noah?
Well, I'm kind of, as you were talking, kind of reminded of our friend Toby Cuccini, who now runs a bar in, or two bars in Brooklyn, Long Island Bar and Rockwell Place. But he had worked at the Odeon, the famous downtown Tribeca bar, which was on the cover, at least the paperback edition of Bright Lights, Big City, the J.A. Mm-hmm. McInerney hit. And there, Toby makes the modern cosmopolitan, right? Which is, he'd taken a recipe that came from San Francisco and kind of adjusted it. It became a staff favorite at the Odeon. And then it, you know, because of their clientele, and it kind of blows up and goes viral, right? Before there was even such a thing as the internet. It went viral the old fashioned way. And suddenly, you know, it's being featured on TV. And one of the products that is featured in the, or required to make the drink is Absolut. And, you know, that really helps push everything, all the ingredients, to a new level and kind of take drinking of cocktails to sort of bring it back. I mean, like, you know, with Sex and the City and all these other shows, where Mad Men later on, where you really see some of the drinks that come from these craft cocktail bars kind of making their way into, you know, TV shows and movies and books and kind of, I mean, I think Dave's right that it's not that these small bars in New York or LA or Chicago are serving thousands of people, but they're serving very influential clientele who then have a platform to spread these drinks, or these drinks then get picked up by large chains like the Applebee's of the world or TGIF Fridays, right? And that's kind of the goal, was that to get everybody to be drinking well, right? Not just a few people. And now we're kind of seeing, I mean, I think Dave's right that the last 2 years have obviously been very challenging, and we'll see what kind of trends come out of there. I do think a lot of folks have been making drinks at home, kind of like during Prohibition, where since bars have been open and closed or not, where people don't want to go out to them. So they've been making drinks at home. And that's an encouraging sign for after this pandemic's over. But I think also we're seeing cocktails and fine spirits kind of entering the more casual dining chains, so that like it's, they pick up on the sort of fine dining and the bars, and they're hard to open a restaurant or a hotel, you know, anywhere in the country without including a back bar of high-end spirits and some menu of cocktails and things like old fashions, where even 15 years ago in New York were fairly uncommon. I mean, even at the craft cocktail bars, people weren't drinking old fashioned, and Negronis were still fairly uncommon. And now both of those drinks are some of the most popular drinks in America and have just sort of exploded. So
I knew things were going crazy when I started seeing sidewalk signs in front of bars on the Lower East Side, which is full of very trendy restaurants, advertising their old fashions. And I was like, okay, that is new. You know, that's the oldest drink there is. And now it's also the trendiest drink there is. And this was, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Now it would probably be the Negroni first.
Your book has an entry on the environmental impact of distillation. Are you seeing an increased focus on environmental sustainability more generally affect the spirits industry? How is that playing out?
Absolutely. We are seeing from a lot of the bartenders this idea of, like, you know, really asking some hard questions of some of the distilleries. Back in the day, you know, as we outline the early history of distillation, it's a farm product. And one of the reasons why farmers like making whiskey was because the leftover spent grains could be then used as feed for the animal. So it was kind of a closed circuit, zero waste product where the animals, you know, their manure would then be used for the next season's grain to help the crops grow. And then, you know, there's very little wasted there, where now we have to think about things like water treatment. What happens to the spent grain? A lot of it's still either sold or given to farmers. Some of the more technologically savvy or entrepreneurial areas of the spirits world are using things like biodigesters to kind of convert the spent grain into energy to sort of help close the loop. You know, people like Jose Cuervo are trying to use all the spent agave to make auto parts, houses, bricks, straws. I mean, like, they're really, I mean, it's a huge thing, because even to treat the spent agave is a big deal before it can even be used as, like, fertilizer. So a lot of brands are kind of not only trying to figure out a solution for their waste, but how that waste can be utilized so it replaces things like plastics in our landfills.
So there's also a lot of work being done on packaging. And in the 19th century, distilleries moved to bottling their own products as a guarantee of quality. And now people are starting to look at that as saying, maybe we'll go back to returnable packaging. They ship spirits out in bulk to distribution centers where bars send their bottles to be refilled locally rather than shipping bottles all the way around the world. And there are pioneer systems going on to do that too, because that's a huge part of the environmental impact is the shipping and the packaging. So there's definitely work going on.
I mean, that goes kind of back to the whole idea of barrels too, where in America, to make straight bourbon or rye or Tennessee whiskey, you can only use a new barrel, a new oak, charred oak barrel. Those barrels, once they've been used, are then sent all over the world. So, I mean, you get some environmental benefit because the barrel is used again by scotch makers or rum makers or tequila makers or, you know, people all over the world. But obviously you also have to ship the barrel, like, you know, around the world empty, but it's, you know, that's still environmental.
They take them down at least.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. But it's a really interesting question. And some of it, for years, the Scotch Whiskey Association, for like single malts, they have to be bottled in Scotland before they come to America, where like blends can be tankered over here and then bottled in America. So it's some of the stuff that we kind of saw as like a demarcation of quality, or, you know, or something being a premium product, now conflicts with the idea of being sustainable or more environmentally friendly, which is, you know, obviously things that we're going to have to work out.
One of the impressive features of your book is that it takes a global view of the business. You have an entry on Wu Yang Ye, a Chinese distillery that has an annual output of 4 million liters, which is
400 million
liters, which is an extraordinary amount of alcohol. Tell us about that company, the Chinese market, and how you expanded your focus outside of the Americas and Europe.
Well, I'll start with in 2011, I was fortunate enough to visit a different Chinese distillery along with the great bartender Dale DeGroff. And he and I got to go to the Kuaichou Moutai Distillery, which had just been named the most valuable spirits company on the planet, taking everybody in the West by surprise. And so they mounted a press trip. And we went, and this distillery is made up of 100 smaller distilleries all along a river valley with thousands of employees and some of the highest tech I've ever seen. And also a lot of people with shovels, shoveling grain into pits in the ground. And Wuliang Ye is another one like that. These are enormous enterprises run at absolutely gargantuan scale. And yet the processes they're using go back hundreds and hundreds of years. Wuliang Ye, it's in Sichuan. It's a Yangtze in Yibin, a Yangtze River port. And they're supposedly the inventor of one of the styles of baijiu. And you know, baijiu just means white liquor in China. And it's basically its styles are as distinct as gin and Scotch whiskey. They're very different. So we almost have to think of them as different spirits. And the one that it's a pioneer of, or the inventor of, a style of strong aroma baijiu, which is very pungent and funky and intense, made from a mixture of grains. And they pioneered that. And they pioneered that in the 10th century. So it's very old. I mean, it's been through a lot of changes since, but I mean, this is what we're dealing with. And one of the things that really got me as editor-in-chief convinced that this book had to be global was that visit to China and to see the scale that things are done at, and to realize that the world of spirits as we know it in modern America and Europe is only a part of the world of spirits as it exists in the world. We're only getting a few of the spirits that are made. We don't really have palm spirits made from palm sap here in America. And yet there are huge parts of the world that drink that. Our representation of Chinese spirits is very small. And yet, you know, these companies exist that are just absolutely massive. And it goes on. And I also thought that that's kind of the most interesting part of the story is the global scale of distillation of the spirits industry and of this enterprise and the amazingly different ways people have found of solving a fairly simple technical problem. How do I get alcohol separated from water? And all the types of stills and distilling and all the ways of making that taste good, aging, filtering, flavoring, and sweetening, et cetera. All that kind of comes together into one big global story, really.
You mentioned at one point in the book that brandy, rum, gin, and whiskey were the core of the Atlantic trade in spirits in the 19th century, and they're still globally popular beverages. In the 20th century, we saw the addition of vodka and tequila to that group. What categories or brands do you think are poised to become central to the Western spirits world?
That's a tough question. I'm a terrible prognosticator. But, you know, the things people said about tequila in the 50s and are kind of the same things a lot of people say about baijiu today is that, you know, what is this stuff? This is really weird. I don't think we can drink this. So that's possible. But, you know, there has to be an occurring and growing trendiness of Chinese things for that to happen. I mean, Scotch became popular in America, blended Scotch in particular, when golf became popular. And it rode in on the back of the golf caddy, basically. And there's always something like that. So to make a prediction like that, you have to know which way culture is going. And boy, right now, I got to say, it kind of beats the hell out of me.
Well, I think it's sometimes kind of like chocolate, right? Like most people, when they start eating chocolate, eat milk chocolate, right? And the more chocolate they eat, the darker they go until it's like, you know, the 90% cacao, right? And I think people, you know, whether it's cocktails and spirits, people in America, we generally start to gravitate towards sweet things, right? And as we, you know, drink, whether it's sweet cocktails with juices and simple syrup, and as you drink more of them, people gradually, you know, go to drier and drier cocktails or more bitter ones. And I think the same thing we see with whiskey, where, you know, people start with things like Maker's Mark, which is wheated, so it's a little bit sweeter. And then as they drink more, they get sort of to like maybe a high rye bourbon and then rye. And then the same thing with scotches, you know, from the Highlands to like the really smoky peaty ones in Islay. And, you know, I think, you know, being in the industry, we often kind of lose sight of the, you know, what people outside the industry are drinking, and things like rye whiskey. I think there's still a huge way for rye to get back to where it was. I mean, it's one of the most popular spirits in America and the world. And it's come back. I mean, as Dave said, the distillers would make it one day a year, and now they make it one day a month. But like, there's still a lot more room for rye whiskey to come back. Mezcal too, I think, you know, has, we've seen a lot of initial popularity around it, you know, but as people drink more tequila, you know, and other spirits, they want bigger, bolder flavors. Mezcal can kind of bring that in. A lot of people still haven't had that. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, spirits with even bigger, bolder flavors will be the ones that we'll see in the near future. And then, you know, who knows? I mean, there are all types of weird trends and outliers that you know, sort of pop up unexpectedly. Oh, and you know,
I'm waiting for a spirit to break out from West Africa, and I think it will happen.
Yeah,
because there's a desire for African culture, and I suspect there are entrepreneurs working on West African palm spirits or something else from West Africa that will have a compelling story, and that we'll see that like burst onto the scene. But
I meant something more like banana liqueur or something, or like, you know, something random, not particularly high quality.
Well, you never know.
It's some kind of weird shot or cocktail or something. And then I think you're right. Things from parts of the world where we don't yet get a lot of spirits. India makes a huge number of whiskeys. We're only just beginning to get those in America.
As Philippines have a huge amount of production.
Arak. I mean, Dave, you've probably done more for Arak in America with your book about punch and all of the, you know, how Arak was, and the articles that you've written for the Daily Beast about Arak. You know, obviously it's still wildly popular in a lot of parts of the world. I could see more Arak coming from places like Sri Lanka and, you know, to America. So as people especially want to make all these traditional punch recipes. So, I mean, there's still a lot out there that we don't get in America. And that excites me as both a journalist and also as somebody who likes to drink spirits and cocktails, that there's all this stuff that's still out there that we don't get on a regular basis.
There's a great entry in your book by Jeff Beachbum Berry on the tiki bar that I bring up, because it's a very sophisticated story of how changing social trends are manifested in the world of spirits and cocktails. Mm-hmm. The tiki bar being very popular with World War II veterans, and then much less popular during Vietnam, and then sees a rise in popularity. And in the last couple of years, seems much more politically problematic. If you were to do another edition of this book in 10 years, or someone takes on that task in a generation, what topic, you know, might we then write about in the way he writes about the tiki bar?
Well, the so-called speakeasy bar, the modern speakeasy bar, I think is ripe for that kind of analysis. I mean, right now, I think perhaps its era has been maybe clipped by COVID. We'll see if it comes back. But that idea of you know, bartenders as these unapproachable artisans, disinterestedly pursuing their art, and, you know, making complex, very demanding cocktails, and, you know, operating at the highest peak of the craft. Some of that was very silly, and some of that was pretty exclusionary. And I think that will need to be treated with a similar sophistication to make sense of it for future generations. Already I'm seeing a younger generation that really didn't understand what was going on, and they're kind of baffled at the speakeasy bar of 15 years ago. So I suspect that one's going to be ripe for that kind of treatment.
Dave, the book contains images, many of which come from your collection of cocktail and spirits memorabilia. How did you go about building the collection, and where are you focused in expanding it now?
Ooh, I love talking about that kind of thing, I have to say. Well, partly, I always keep an eye out for images of distilleries from the past, things like that, where the image shows me how they were doing things. I'm very focused on process. I'm the son and grandson of engineers, and so the engineering story is always big for me. You know, how did they actually make this in the past? And how is it different from how they make it now? So anything with pictures of that, I will compulsively collect. Also, examples of packaging. We've got a photo of a hand-blown Smirnoff vodka bottle from Imperial Russia, for instance. That kind of thing I'm always interested in. Really tokens of important brands in the past, especially when they're no longer with us. And so for years, I've been picking up stuff in thrift stores, picking up stuff on eBay, book dealers, and any place I can find it. I mean, that stuff is always very interesting to me. But because I don't have a huge 800 plus page book to illustrate, I'm not collecting as widely as I was. But I do have I've got a couple little very deep collections. One of the things I collect is early stuff on tequila drinks, for instance. Why? I don't know. It started off as I was researching the history of the margarita, and I ended up with a little collection, and little collections want to be big collections. I keep adding to that one. I collect menus of restaurants and bars in Mexico that have tequila drinks, for instance. So it's always something like that.
And then finally, I would be remiss if I did not ask each of you what your favorite spirit and cocktail is, which I know may be difficult to answer given your encyclopedic knowledge of the cocktail and spirit universe.
Noah, you want to start?
I was hoping that you'd get us out of this, Dave.
Well, I'll start then. You know, it's like choosing among your children. Some of your children are maybe more like you than others, and some you understand better, but you love them all. And the cocktail, my favorite spirit is rum and whiskey and Geneva and mezcal and tequila. You know, it's really hard, but when I'm home, if I have to choose something, I really like old cognacs because I can. And that to me is my comfort spirit of choice. And cocktails, I don't stray far from the martini / Manhattan school, you know, of spirit with vermouth, or from the daiquiri spirit with citrus and a little sweetener. And within those families, that's what I like to drink. I keep it very simple.
I think that, you know, working on this project, they become not even drinks, but like almost like close friends or relatives, right? And like, you know, some of them, you know, you want to see a lot. Some of them, you know, once a year at the holidays is enough, you know, and it's like, you know, for various reasons, either they were hard entries for us to get somebody to write, or turned out better than expected, or they were frustrating in some other way. So like the book has definitely left its impression on all the drinks. And to be honest, I kind of find myself often now, maybe it's the last 2 years, but kind of gravitating also to the simple things like the highball. You know, it's basically, you know, whether it's cognac or brandy or whiskey with, you know, a splash of good club soda is delicious. You know, we were talking about the rise of Irish whiskey. You know, one of the secrets to success of Jameson, which has, you know, literally been on fire in terms of sales the last 2 decades, is that people feel free to mix it with good ginger ale or ginger beer. And now you have all these wonderful mixers available, you know, on the market. So I find myself, you know, whether it's whiskey and ginger beer or dark and stormy or Moscow Mule, like, you know, all these drinks are simple, refreshing, delicious. They go with food. They're good out, you know, with snacks, easy to make. And it's just, you know, it's good to have fresh limes on hand, I think, is the lesson, you know, for all people, to have fresh lemons and limes and a hand juicer. And basically, you can make any drink you want. Right. If you have that. So it doesn't take much to make great drinks. And obviously we have dozens and dozens of not only the history, but also the recipe for all the drinks in the book. So hopefully reading it, you'll get thirsty and you'll want to make yourself a drink.
David, Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having us, David.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.